Hello, you're listening to a Zen Studies Society podcast. To learn more about our community of Zen Buddhist practitioners, please visit zenstudies.org.
Remember during the past winter, you wished for a warm day. Your wishes have been fulfilled. One of the phrases that comes across frequently is true. One of the words is true. True practice, true dharma, true intention. And so today I would like to talk about three truths, if you will. The first one comes from Rinzai, and it has to do with the disposition of the student. As you come to this practice, this zendo, this session, this moment, Rinzai says, true sincerity is extremely difficult to obtain. And the Buddha Dharma is deep and mysterious. I expound it all day long, but you monks, nuns, lay people, pay not the slightest heed. Even though you trample it underfoot 1,000, 10,000 times a day, you remain in utter darkness. It is without a vestige of form, and yet distinct in its solitary shining. I've gone through Rinzai quite a bit. I even baptized it on one occasion. I poured coffee all over it. Find a page that really, you can't see it now because it's sort of dried out, but this top is all stained. It's good coffee. The second one has to do with practice. I remember in my remote past, at the last session, I talked about three pillars of Hoenji, and they were meditation, practice, and tradition. Now, there's a story out of our past. This is a true story. I have no reason to doubt it. That one day before the Pacific War, the small Sangha to which Soen Roshi belonged were about to have session. But they did not have a keisaku. Now that's pretty far out. Didn't have a keisaku. So he volunteered to go borrow one. So he went down the street and around the corner a bit until he came to this other zendo. Can you imagine having so many zendos there every few blocks? Closest zendo to this one is far away. So he came in to borrow the keisaku, and it turned out that Genpo Roshi was giving a talk at that time. So Soen said, well, okay, we'll listen to this guy, see what he has to say. So he sat down, and Genpo Roshi proceeded to talk, and he was an impressive man. And at one point during his talk, he mentioned that Zen practice must be true practice. And he said this several times, and while he did, he looked pointedly right at Soin, who was sitting more or less in the front row. True practice, Soin-san. And this left a great impression on Soin, so much so that he decided to go study with him, which he did, and received a transmission from him. And that's why Genpo Roshi is in our lineage that we chant in the evening. So, true practice. And then finally, the third truth, once again back to Renzai. Helps to have glasses on. Renzai, Master Renzai says, virtuous monks, nuns, lay people, make no mistake. I don't care if you understand the sutras and the shastras, commentaries. If you are a king or a high minister, or if you are as eloquent as a rushing torrent, or if you are clever or wise, I only want you to have true insight. So here we have three truths. We must be true to ourselves, in ourselves. Never perfect, but constantly making the effort. And next, true practice. You can ask, what is true practice? There are very many kinds of practices. I was down at DBZ one day after session, and the lady who had been teaching yoga was not a member of the Sangha, was not a Zen student, but she participated. And I heard her comment to someone else, just very briefly. She said, Zen does not own meditation. And that's true. So there are many paths. There's a saying about picking a path, it goes like this. All paths lead nowhere. Choose a path with heart. So true practice, we can think, imagine, has to do with whether or not a true practice for us, for each person, has to do with whether or not it engages your heart, mind, and your hara. Or whether you're just smorgasbording down the line. So true practice. And finally, true insight. What is true insight? It helps to be teaching under the leadership of a true teacher. A lineage teacher in whatever lineage you happen to find yourself. We find ourselves in the Renzai lineage. And thus, having a Renzai lineage teacher goes a long way to ensuring that what we're studying, the standards we're trying to meet, are in fact on the road to true insight. So let's go back and look at these three truths just a little bit. true sincerity. Most of us here have heard my bit on true sincerity, so we won't go into that. Those who haven't heard it can be mysteriously curious. But it has to do with being totally dedicated. Totally dedicated. I was reading a book by Joan Stambo the other night entitled Impermanence is the Buddha nature. And I was reading down in there, and at some point in the text, she makes the phrase, or writes the phrase, an existential leap. And I thought to myself, what the bejesus is an existential leap? And so I spent some time just on that phrase, an existential leap. And I wondered why she didn't say an existential jump. She says, leap. You know, you jump rope, you go up and down. Or you jump over a log if you're out hiking. And a jump more or less leaves you in position. It only requires that you think it might be necessary and you think you might have the wherewithal to make a jump. Back in my bicycle racing days, I used to try to jump rope. That's a good aerobic exercise. And you count how many you can do. And, you know, any sixth grader can do close to 1,000. And I usually missed it at somewhere between 40 and 50. And I would start over. But, yeah. But this leap, a leap takes you someplace. Leap forward. When you land, you're not in the same place. And an existential leap, I imagined as I was thinking about this, meant that I was making a leap from one understanding of myself, one organization, if you will, of who and what I was and. And I take this existential leap. I decide to go out of this and in that direction. I leap out of myself. And to do that requires a great deal of faith and courage. Just imagine something with which you identify yourself. You're a student, you're married, you're not married, you're old, you're young, you're a this, you're a that. And you decide to change. I was once upon a time an electronics engineer. I worked on air-to-ground missiles. Some of the things they're using in the Ukraine today, not the same thing, but the same type of thing. And other things, superintendent of nuclear weapons at one point. And I decided through a long story, which isn't private, but I won't bore you with it right now, I decided to become a clinical psychologist. And that bothered my father, who had been an engineer out of West Point and had spent 30 years in the service and was dedicated to his family, his country, and his job. And the idea of changing jobs and changing careers, this existential leap, he couldn't understand. He said he supported me, but he just would shake his head no. And says, I hope nothing bad happens to you. So it was this leap, going from something most often into the unknown. When you first decided to come to your first session, there was somewhat of an existential leap in that. What's this, 3 days? Or maybe first session for me was down at Daivasatsu. That was 7 days. And that's not true. I did go to a 3-day session down at Shoboji before. But that was just in the preamble. First session I really went to, so to speak, was 7 days, and it was about 5 or 6 years, maybe more, 10 years. And that was the only kind of session I went to. It was a long session. Whether it's short or long is immaterial. There was a point where you sort of had to say, well, maybe yes, maybe no, I'll take a chance. And you leapt. And you landed on a black cushion. And your story now changes and unfolds in a different direction. So this true sincerity means making this existential leap. Going from, well, I'll try it out, or it's interesting, or my partner, wife, or husband, or someone is trying to coax me into going, so, well, okay. Where you have cross-cultural curiosities, you want to see what the Japanese were doing in America. And none of these involve a leap. A leap is when you leave where you are and leap into a direction where you've never been. And we must be prepared in Dharma practice, Zazen, to not only make one leap, because as we get deeper and more thoroughly involved, we find that there are other places that are sort of bewildering, and we have this sort of, well, maybe yes, maybe no. And so another leap is required. Yes, I will. Well, suppose it doesn't turn out. Well, it doesn't turn out. Indian chief in the movie, A Little Big Man, one of his phrases that I really like, he says, sometimes the magic works, sometimes it doesn't. So you make this leap. Hopefully, you have good prospects, but you don't know. There is no guarantee. And this is something you can only do for yourself. And you may make this existential leap and then look back on it and said, well, it may have been, but it was only about 6 inches long. Mm-hmm. So the big leap into emptiness. The big leap into just sitting. Those who've practiced it for just one sitting will see all their harmful karma erased. So one sitting. And how long is a sitting? Well, traditionally 30, 45 minutes. Every now and then you'll run into a 1-hour sitting. But just one sitting, there's no stipulation on the time. So just sit, fold your hands. Center your attention. Can change your whole life forever. then you may not realize how deep and thoroughgoing that change is until downstream. Just one city. And Genpo Roshi says, true practice, true water, what is true practice? Well, true practice has a certain central tendency, but allowing for that, everybody's practice is, to some extent, different, even if you're working on the same koan as the next person in line. Your way of working on it is going to be different, have subtle variations. So Roshi sits and participates in our doksan, and she has to go with the wind. The wind of the practice behind this individual. So true practice is one that you confidently commit yourself to. However long the Buddha way is, I vow to follow it. At the advanced age of 83, my beloved having passed before me last September, leaving me with a house of 60 years accumulated stories in history. And so one of the things I'm trying to do these days is weed out the superficial stuff from the heartfelt stuff, so that my goal is that when I'm dead and the kids come to do something with the house, there is nothing that they have to throw away. All the throwawayables have been thrown away, and everything that remains has some value, maybe monetary value, personal value, family value, value for the Sangha. It has some value. And this occurs on the computer, too. You know, I've been active on a computer since 1983. 83, 93, 103, 140 years. That's longer than some people here have been born. And I always get a kick out of when I have to call up for some support, and the person, you know, something's not working, the person on the other end of the line, he says, check to see that it's plugged in. And I say, yeah, okay, I've mastered plugging things in, you know. I think I've got that far. So anyway, there's a section in there on Zen, and under Zen there's this and that and next thing, and I came across this short piece that I wrote. Must have been about 1968. 69, somewhere right there. No. 1990. During the year of Roshi's transmission, 1998, yeah? Okay. The background to this, some of you know, most of you know, that right about that time, to celebrate Roshi's receiving transmission, the Zendo burned down. And in fact, not only did it burn down, it burned down about 3 days before the ceremony. So I wrote this, and ask your patience while I read it. Fundamentally, true practice is not limited to any particular form, place, or time. At the same time, in the world of form, true practice appears this way, in that place, or at some time. Now, one form of Zen practice in the Rinzai tradition is session, a Japanese word meaning collected mind or one-pointed mind. We come to session to gather ourselves in and focus. We focus during the day and during our jobs and our daily routine, but there are many legitimate demands on our focus. Whereas in session, hopefully, we can leave most of that outside the door and only focus on this one matter and bring ourselves into its presence. For a period of several days, the Sangha gathers for intense Zazen, bringing from before sunrise and lasting long after sunset. Everyday matters are put aside, and each participant looks into this matter with great intensity and courageous persistence. That word matter is significant also. We don't say, I want you to look into this issue. I want you to look into this theory. I want you to look into this tradition. I want you to look into this book by Rinzai. It's this matter, something real, and yet quite naturally, every effort is made to prepare for session so that everything supports the participants as much as possible, thanks to the residents. At ONG, this preparation included finishing touches to the renovation of the Carriage House Zendo. And in particular, laying a fine wooden floor made from oak panels, distressed old barn wood. Yet despite our best efforts, session began without the beautiful floor. You can see out there our original idea for this whole place, but we could never quite get it together. So went in this direction. In its place lay a mosaic of rough construction plywood and old carriage house flooring. Paint and plaster stains were everywhere. Gouges and splinters left over from the construction made walking difficult. The unfinished floor confronted each of us with an unavoidable visual reminder of the world of samsara, so-called imperfection. Pain, suffering. For myself, having been involved in the flooring project, it was a disappointment. And I began session with Scott's words, Scott of the Antarctic expedition. He was in a race with Admundson to the South Pole. Admundson went with dogs and sleds. Dog sled. His idea was you get to the South Pole, and then as you come back, you can, God bless them, you can slaughter the dogs and use them for meat as you come back. Scott, in some blaze of insight, decided that he was going to his troop, they were going to tow everything. So he had about seven or eight people in his party, and he started off from the base on the Ross Sea, and he started overland, lugging these two or three sleds. He had, you know, maybe a ton of supplies on each one of them. So here it is in, must have been summer at the South Pole. That's not much of an improvement over winter. Has more light, but it's still cold. And they trudged and trudged over 1,000 miles from their home base towards the South Pole. And along the way, a few people died. And when he got there, he saw the marker that Edmonston had been there before, I think about a month before, beat him to the South Pole. So he turned around and started back, and I think there were only about five of them at this point, pulling their sled of supplies. And as they pulled, they got weaker, colder. And another man died, and it got down to three of them. And they were in this tent, just about 90 miles from their goal. They could almost, in the flat clarity of the South Pole, they could almost see this big supply dump that they had pre-positioned out there, but they couldn't get there. It was storming, and they were just not up to it. And so one night, as they were huddled in the cold, trying to find as little warmth as they could, Oates, one of the men, stood up and said, "I'm going outside, and I may be some time." And now there were two of them. Now, Scott had left a journal, or kept a journal, all the way, every day. He would write to the South Pole and back. And his last entry, before he too died in that tent, his last entry was, "There were risks. We knew there were risks. And we took them anyway. Things have come out against us. We have no reason to complain." And so I began session with Scott's words from the doomed Antarctic expedition floating through my mind. "Things have come out against us. Just this ratty construction floor, paint, plaster, gouges, turpentine. Probably somebody pissing in the corner over there." It was not a pretty sight. For hour after hour of zazen, I sat watching the jumble of distressed plywood. All manners of thoughts concerning flooring arose and fell in my mind. During Tinhin, I discreetly picked safe places for each footstep so as to avoid splinters. It was my flooring koan. And after a while, I found myself ever more deeply saturated with all the personal and internal issues that the unfinished floor was bringing out of me. And like a good teacher, the floor would not let me go. And zazen became an ongoing doksan that I could not avoid. People start out at session, and they go to session, they go to doksan, they don't go. I remember I went about half the time, and that continued for a while, until one session I said, "You know, this is ridiculous. Go every time. As long as I don't have anything to say, go every time." And that in itself became a practice. Go to doksan every time. And in fact, some of the most precious doksans that I recall with Edo Roshi was when I went in and had nothing to say, nothing to demonstrate, nothing to offer. I don't know when it happened. Such moments are so often lost as one tosses about within the darkness. But I eventually became aware of a change of heart towards the floor. What had begun as a distracting and disappointing distraction had changed into an intimate encounter. That existential leap. When I was married, the service said, you know, you do not know what the future holds for the two of you. But still, you make these vows in the face of the unknown, existential leap out of being a single man to being a married man. Changed everything. The distressed plywood that I had wished to be covered in golden planks had become the true floor. True practice. True floor. The foundation of practice, the imperfectly perfect. We all want things to be just so, most of the time. We're willing to tolerate a little stupidity and craziness, but down in our hearts, we would just as soon as if everything worked out more or less as we expect and plan, most of the time. Not this floor. The distressed plywood that I had wished to be covered in golden planks had become the true floor, the foundation of practice, true practice. At some point, I took off the double socks with which I had been protecting my feet from the splinters. And for the first time, I felt the floor on my bare feet. And I remembered and understood Soen Roshi's teachings concerning kinging. He would say, place your soul on the soles of your feet so that right here, where your foot meets the floor. If you look closely enough, you'll find the essence of Zen, essence of practice. I found myself placing my hand on the floor gently, affectionately, thankfully, things as they are. Perfect. This rough, unfinished floor would soon be covered with finished flooring. Here it is. And it would be hidden from eyes, perhaps for a very long time. We all hope that the Zendo, the Sangha, Zen Center of Syracuse, ONG, propagates down through the years. Hopefully someday our names will just be curiosities in a history book. This is the way of the Bodhisattva. Selfless giving without adornment and with no desire for recognition or payment. right here. The simple floor also reminded me of my appreciation for the simple and straightforward Zen practice at Hoenji. For almost 25 years, there had been no property, no budget, no pretense, just sitting. Now, for mysterious reasons, we find ourselves owning land in a beautiful zendo that sits at a historic crossroads where Native Americans once camped and drank clean water. Many of us know, but I'm sure there are some people here who don't appreciate the location of this zendo. When the Sangha was trying to find a place, we went through several different houses. We looked at one house that was $100,000 over in the Westcott area. Not right. Besides, we couldn't afford it. So then we found another place up on the north side. I think that was around $70,000, $80,000. That wasn't quite right either. And we couldn't afford $70,000 or $80,000. So then through a karmic connection that Roshi had, it came to our attention that this property was available for only $180,000. And we came down here and looked at it and we said, we can afford $180,000. And we bought this property, or at least signed a mortgage on it. And through the efforts of the Sangha and Roshi and Toku and everybody, slowly but surely, in a relatively short space of time, we paid it off. But before we paid it off, we decided to buy the house next to us. That came into, now we had a liability of something like $250,000, $250,000. And, damnedest thing, we paid that off too. So now, for no financially understandable reason, Zen Center of Syracuse, Hoenji, is the custodian, the steward of this stretch of land. And we were very happy. That was nice. But then it became clear or clearer, it started to become clear that this was not just any piece of land. That this was, to the Onondaga Nation, sacred land. It was land that sat at the junction of the Seneca Trail, east and west. Onondaga Creek, north and south. And at this intersection, which was known throughout the Onondaga Nation, came under our stewardship. And there was a sense when we bought the land that we weren't really buying it. We were borrowing it from the Onondaga Nation. And certain realities required money. The previous owner, who may not have been quite as aware of this as we were, he wanted his investment, so he forked over the money. And so here we sit. Not just on these cushions, not just these tatami mats, not just this fake floor, not the true floor underneath it, but deep down under that, the earth, sacred earth, And so when we sit, we are supported by generations of people. Generations of holiness. And so when we sit, we want to make sure that we receive that gift, amplify it and strengthen it for all those who will come after us. So we are just one link in the chain. The very first session that we had on this property was over in the big house there in the Dharma Hall. I think we had about 10 people. And the mood of that session was, let's leave a good impression for those who are going to follow. So each of us are being nourished by those who have come before. Just sitting, now we own this land. Such good fortune like this, however, comes and goes, and we cannot presume that tomorrow is going to be anything like today. I can vouch for that. However, as long as the Buddha Dharma is plainly, directly reflected in our practice, pilgrims will find refuge here, and the waters will be clear and refreshing. And true insight. True insight is not insight into something that's invisible. True insight might better be said as true appreciation. Seneca Trail, Onondaga Creek, appreciation. With true insight, you can really realize and feel your place in this ongoing tradition. So instead of just stopping by and tasting the tea, you can become the tea. True insight, I would think, involves a profound thankfulness for all of those, a profound sense of responsibility for all of those, and a joyfulness. At the moment of his insight, Hakuin says, "Wonderful, wonderful, yet still more wonderful." And Renzai at several places says, just chopping wood and carrying water, that's become a real Zen phrase. And basically what it means is just doing what you're doing, where you're doing it, when you're doing it. Insight does not lift one out of reality and deposit you on the moon. True insight deepens your participation in the reality that is your everyday life. True insight is tangling your eyebrows with the old men and women. Tangling your eyebrows with the future men and women. Time just becomes a word. And you are at the crossroads of existence. The monk came to Joshua and said, "Would you please instruct me?" Joshua said, "Have you had the morning meal?" Monk says, "Yes." Joshua says, "Go wash your bowls." Now there's subtle dimensions to that koan, but in the manner of speaking, those subtle dimensions are no more important than just that matter of fact. You got dirty bowls, wash them. The floor is dusty. Sweep it. If your bank book, you don't know how much money you got, sit down and balance it. Merely according to circumstances, I use my past karma. Present, use my karma. Renzai says, I just blend in with circumstances in a profound way so that there is no body, there is no practice, there's no time, there is no place that is incidental or unimportant. Every little thing, it every little thing as I'm slowly going through the stuff in our house, I come across little cards that Sandra would send me. Just not sometimes through the mail. She would send me cards when I was working through the mail, boxes of them. But lots of times, just a little note that she would put on my pillow. And I'll come across these little things. A few words. And in that small little thing, note, I can relive my whole life with her. Little things. And if little things don't seem important to you, then spend some time with them. Tune in your ears to what they're saying. Dharma talks by insentient beings. This plank right here, this board, has a teaching that is ever so slightly different from this one and this one. And our whole life is that way. So you might summarize it by saying, get yourself together, be sincere. Pay attention to little things joyfully. And then listen what the little things are sharing with you.
This has been a Zen Studies Society podcast. If you found it to be of interest, please consider making a donation by visiting zenstudies.org/donate. Thank you for listening.